Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
This is why you do it. Nick Osello. This is why we host the Tailgate Podcast. And literally it is, because we didn't host it last week, not because the games weren't very good, but you did say if there was a week not to do a podcast, which we didn't because we ran into immense technical difficulties, last week was the one to do it. But boy, howdy, could that not be the case for this week. Welcome to week two of men's college lacrosse. We have so much to discuss, but we are not going to start in the poorly named JMA Wireless Dome in Syracuse, New York. We are going to start somewhere on the mean streets of Boise, Idaho, because Nick Osello's got a life update for us.
Terry, first off, I'm a hardened, tough, ragged criminal after this weekend. So the story that I've been waiting to tell you is I got my first ticket. Now, I asked you this over text. What is the least offensive charge you could think of?
Yep. Jaywalking has to be the least offensive, correct?
I would say less offensive than jaywalking, given the circumstances. I got hit with a brutal $300 ticket. So if you're listening to this, you better Venmo me right now, or I'm going to wind up on the streets of Boise. I took my girlfriend, Bragg, if you're listening to this, you probably don't have one. I do. And our lovely dog, Molly, Lab Husky Mix, 45 minutes into the mountains. And we were going up and down the mountains. I started, I've been getting into rucking, which is just you load up a backpack with weights. So I had like 2 cast iron skillets, like 8 water bottles, and I was just walking up and down the mountain.
Wait, hold on. Are the cast iron skillets just for weight, or are you intending to cook on the mountain?
Just for weight. I don't have like heavy things that are compact. The closest thing that I have is cast iron skillets. So I'm just a lunatic carrying cast iron skillets up a mountain, dying. Like, I am out of breath. Molly's, you know, running up and down. There's nobody, you know, on this probably 2-hour excursion. We saw about 3 people. We get hit with an off-leash dog penalty in the sticks of Idaho. So we come back down to the parking lot, and there's fish and game wardens, 2 of them. And there's this other guy that we were walking on the hike. We passed him, and he was like, oh, yeah, you know, how do you, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, dude, you're kind of a loser dork. Please leave us alone. I'm carrying cast iron skillets up the mountain. We come back. He is screaming at the fish and game warden. So they are in bad moods. And they were like, hey, man, like, we hate to do this. Like, it's one of the 3 weekends where our supervisors tell us we have to crack down on this. But did you have your dog off leash? And I have an uncle that works for the fish and game. So I'm like, hey, listen, guys, like, I respect what you do. Let's call a spade a spade. Yeah, like, the dog was off leash. What's even the penalty here? Like, we're in the mountains. It's not like I have a freaking rabid dog running around downtown in the city.
Right.
We're in the mountain. Terry, we're in the mountains. I can't express enough how there is nobody around us. And so we come back.
Hold on. Let me quick time out. Are we thinking that the guy that you passed tattled on you?
I think he was so irate. He was like, you're getting me for our dog? What about those guys over there? Either that happened, or they did kind of have like binoculars and were looking up the mountain on the trail. And it's, again, I can't stress enough how it's not a populated trail. It's called Cervide Peak. It's a killer. TD couldn't even finish it. And, you know, people say he's in
did
shape.
He have cast iron skillets in his backpack?
He had no cast iron on his back, and he couldn't even finish. Yeah. So, you know, if you're a pro coach, maybe, you know, renegotiate a lower contract. And so we come back down, and this is where the story gets funny, and partly of why I wanted to share it. So this guy's freaking out, where he's like, you guys don't have anything better to do? Like, this is really how you want to spend your time, like, cussing at these guys? And the guys are like, yeah, no, I know, but it still is a law. We still have to enforce it. And he's like, how do you have proof? Do you have evidence? Show me your evidence. And they're like, we do have evidence. We can't show you right now. And, like, he's walking back to his car, and he's like, do not follow me so close. You are, like, I don't want you to open fire on me. You have firearms on your thing. And I'm like, dude, it, like, they're the fish and game game wardens. Like, you're not going to get shot in the mountains of Idaho. Relax, bro. And so as they're writing us their ticket, the guy, like, I just kind of strike up a conversation. I'm like, whoa, like, that guy's a shit show. Like, I'm not. Like, want to get me out of this ticket because I'm so cool? And he goes, no, like, you know, it came from upper management, blah, blah, blah. Giving me all, you know, the roundabout of, hey, I don't like doing this either. And I'm like, then don't. Then quit. And I was wearing Redwoods sweats. And he goes, oh, you know, see, you have the Redwoods sweats on. Are you a fan? And I'm like, oh, maybe I can. Maybe there is the Hail Mary left to be played. And I go, oh, no, I actually played for them. And he's like, what? No way. Like, you know, there's no pro lacrosse players in Idaho. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I you know, had a good career, blah, blah, blah. Before I can even finish that sentence, my girlfriend goes, do you want a helmet to get us out of this ticket? We'll get you an autographed helmet. And he's like, sorry, like, we're already in the process. And then we just started having fun with it. And I was like, hey, if a helmet doesn't do it, I probably have, like, some game-worn spandex. They might still have skid marks if you want me to, like, frame those and send them to you. And he's like, no, no, like, and then we just started shooting the shit. He was from New York, right outside Buffalo. He was a FOGO, so of course he became a cop. He's a nut.
Did you tell him that you could get him assigned TD anything?
I did. I was like, dude, I'll get you anything you want in lacrosse. And the frustrating part was because the other guy was such a loser, dork, idiot, their supervisor was called just to be on site to help manage the situation. So
the bribes,
like,
just really weren't going to work in that
scenario. So the bribes weren't working, but we continued to up the ante. And my girlfriend and I were like, do you want, like, I'll sign your chest if that'll get us out of it. Like, what, like, you name your, like, name your price, bro. And by the end of it, we actually exchanged phone numbers. And
so you're going to go have a catch.
Well, and we are going to go have a catch. And I was like, yeah, you know, first round on you. And he's like, oh. He's like, oh, first couple rounds on me. Like, again, sorry about all this. There's more important stuff to do. But this is literally one of three weekends. It's just bad timing. So shout out Phil of the Idaho Fishing Game. And last thing that made us laugh was the other guy, like, clearly didn't understand outdoors. Again, he made it, like, up the first section and then was like, I'm a stupid idiot and I can't even get up the mountain. I'm turning back. And he was like, what is your jurisdiction? Do you even have jurisdiction on this mountain? He's asking to the fish and game warden. And the fish and game warden was like, yeah, our jurisdiction is the state of Idaho if you're outside, pretty much. And so we started laughing. But again, supervisor was on site, but just upping the ante of, like, do you want an autographed helmet? Do you want a jersey? Like, do you want game worn spandex? Do you want my dirty sock? Like, do you want our house? Like, just get us out of this ticket. So bottom line, I'm a hardened criminal. Like, do not mess with me because
I tell him that. Did you tell him that you punched Blaze?
Yeah, that I was like, you know, if you're a Redwoods fan, there's only one thing. It wasn't scoring goals. It wasn't this and that. It was the guy who punched the goalie. That was me. And he was like, oh my God, no way. That's great. And I'm like, if it's so great, get me out of this ticket. Yeah,
that was pretty good.
Yeah,
that was pretty
good. And
then
he just kept asking.
It wasn't
about
as good
face-offs.
As getting your apartment broken into and your ACC championship ring stolen, and then somehow getting it back. But that's a pretty good story to kick off this President's Day morning.
Nothing will top the ACC story. But it was just kind of like a funny. We had a good time. And hey, listeners, if you're interested, I have one joke that I'm not saying publicly that I'm going to tell Terry after this episode airs. DM me or DM Terry, and you know, you'll get the secret sauce because that's where it becomes really funny. But we're a professional podcast, and now we can talk about lacrosse. Now that I got that off my chest.
And like I said, there is a lot of lacrosse to talk about, but there's only one place to start. It is, I want to call it old school ACC, but that would imply that Syracuse is an old school ACC team, which they are not. I mean, I guess if you're, you know, younger than 25 years old, they are. But yeah, no, ACC, they're in the Big East. But in any case, Maryland versus Syracuse from the dome.
Oh.
Take it away, Nick.
This game had everything, and it was one of those games where the palpable energy of the back and forth was the highlight for me, because sometimes you see a game that goes into overtime, one team mounts a comeback, you know, maybe it wasn't the interesting, it was kind of like the stall ball. This was the opposite of any like, not that any overtime games are boring, but they're on a spectrum of electricity. This one was as good as it gets. Back and forth, goal for goal, blow for blow. I mean, my goodness, it had great goalie play. This Roa kid for Syracuse, I think, stole the show. I couldn't believe some of the goals that he was scoring in the variety that he showed. Big saves, controversy. So to give a bit of a rundown, slugfest from you know, essentially start to finish, but it really picked up in the second half where you didn't know if this game was going to go into overtime or if one team got hot, they could have ended up winning by five. That was the pace of play. Ended up with the biggest controversy of all time where Syracuse scores a goal. It's reviewed. It's called not a goal because of the goal mouth rule. And then Maryland comes back, and of all the heroes you could choose, and no discredit to Chorus, but what was he even doing on the field? Because of that goal mouth call, it seemed to me like Syracuse was maybe a little unorganized in the ride, which led to a short stick. It wasn't the prettiest shot. It wasn't a low to high stinger bar down, but Chorus standing about 12 yards unguarded for a step down winner. There are so many different players to highlight. Again, goalie
play. Well,
let me
start by saying that the player to highlight is actually George Stamos, not Jack Chorus, because Jack Chorus scored three goals and had an assist, including a really pivotal one off of a faceoff. But it was the short stick D. Mitty who was a better known. First of all, this kid put up 30 goals and 31 assists as a senior in high school as a long pole. And second of all, he was a much better football player at West Potomac, or at least that's kind of his reputation. I don't know if that's actually true because he's playing college lacrosse. But in any case, he was a very good football player in high school, All-State in Virginia. And he was the one that scored the game-winning goal. But you're right, it wasn't the prettiest goal. And to your point about, I don't understand why he was on the field, and we can get into some of the minutiae around the adjudication of the disallowed goal and then the replay review. But you would assume that Maryland would have subbed in that scenario and gotten their offensive middies on, but they didn't. And it, like, if it had just been like a quick restart of play, like, sure, I would have gotten it, but like, that's not what happened. So whatever, it was crazy. But you've got a lot left to unpack as far as what got us to overtime. So continue.
Yeah, and so sorry, I got Chorus and Stamos mixed up, and I'm going to call him John Stamos for the rest of my life.
That you say that, because I'm in the same boat with an Uncle Jesse vibe, but, and this might be crossing some lines, Matt Kinnear was like, all I can think of is George Santos. So really, the guy's getting it from both ends.
I'll say Stamos over Santos. That seems a little nicer. And, you know, again, one quick other note. After the game, it was cool to hear that, you know, Gary Gate was talking to Coach Tillman about, hey, we got some things to do to clean up with the replay rule. But I really liked Coach Gates. It's tough to really sense a coach's presence when you're just watching it through a screen. But that's, you know, you kind of have two options. You can freak out and go scream at the ref and make it this huge thing. Or you can kind of just laugh and go, well, what are you going to do? We should probably revisit the rule. And so I really like that Gary Gate appeared to be more on the side of like, hey, what are you going to do? Like, that was just a great game. We had a good showing. So credit to him. Some other things that were noteworthy. Joey Spallina was held less effective than you might have thought, particularly just because Logan McEnany was good in net against Joey Spallina's shots, which I think was kind of like a little storyline throughout the game. Spallina did have one and two, and the Spallina Zapatello was a great matchup to watch. Sometimes Spallina would get past him and get a shot off. Sometimes Zapatello would strip him. It was a great individual matchup. We just talked about his name, but Luke Roa blew me away with his level of versatility. He ended up having four goals, and those four goals, it's whatever the opposite of like that typecasted, he can only shoot three-pointers in the NBA. He was finishing in close. He was shooting on the run. He was changing lanes, changing angles, changing finishes. He really, really impressed me. Irksa and Chorus And really the interesting note for me as we look forward to the rest of the season, it was their ball movement. Like they were actually wheeling and dealing in a way that we can expect Maryland to wheel and deal. So the long-term storyline for me was what a good game for Maryland to build on offensively. And so that's essentially how we got here, was just a great game highlighted by individual matchups, individual performances, but ultimately a team effort from Maryland that ended up pushing them not only to get to overtime, but to win that overtime. And that's the big question that you just talked about right there was, hey, if it's, you know, after that review, Tillman had time to put this, you know, six best offensive midfield, you know, offensive and attack to try and get that clear, which is what you think would happen. And then John Stamos handsomes his way out of nowhere and ends up finishing the goal. So that's, what am I missing, Terry? I mean, there's so much that I probably missed 15 things.
Yeah, I mean, so I think we'll get into the call in a second. But first, let me just start by framing this. It was the first top five matchup of the season. And it was number four Maryland versus number five Syracuse in the Carrier Dome. And let's call it what it's supposed to be called. And for me, and this is with apologies to the 2013 team that made it to the national championship game and the 2015 team who was number one in this, you know, for times during the season, and the 2020 Syracuse team that was number one when the pandemic hit and the season shut down. For me, the last time that Syracuse was quote-unquote Syracuse insofar as it was led by the stars, which is what the program is, right? You know, they're the Lakers of college lacrosse in the sense that, you know, they are supposed to have star-driven talent. You know, that 2020 team had Brennan Curry and Tucker Dordovic, and the 2015 team had, you know, Kevin Rice and Randy Stotts, and 2013 had JoJo Marasco. But that 2011 team that was when the you know, freshmen and sophomores who won national championships in 2008 and 2009 were seniors. That year they hosted Virginia in a number one versus number two matchup, 2011. And it was, I believe, on like March 4th or March 5th. And they had 14,300 fans in the stands. That, to me, was the last time that the Dome was more alive than it was last night. And they had 7,300 fans. So, like, it's wild to consider that the crowd was almost double the size in that game that I'm referring to 13 years ago. But even still, when you ask the question, is Syracuse back, it can be measured in a number of ways. And one of the ways is, you know, and again, apologies to Loyola, apologies to Denver, apologies to Albany, apologies to Notre Dame, although not really. Syracuse has the best fan base in lacrosse. They have the largest fan base in lacrosse.
Yeah,
SEC.
Okay. Yeah.
They are SEC football fans in lacrosse, and they showed up like Syracuse is back. And then I think it's compounded by the fact that there are stars on this team. And not only are there existing stars, but there are emerging stars. And you mentioned two of them in Luke Roa and Michael Leo, who finished with three goals, and it was his effort that ended up getting waved off. So I think a couple of things that need to be said. So the first was at the faceoff X, Luke Wehrman is, if not the best faceoff guy in the country, the best faceoff guy in the country in terms of being established over the course of the prior 3 or 4 years. So now we know that Syracuse can go toe-to-toe with the best faceoff guys and not lose the game because of the faceoff. And Mason Cohn did a really nice job. And I think that can give some peace of mind to folks who were otherwise optimistic about what they had seen in their first three games and in their scrimmage against Michigan, etc. This was a defensive slugfest in a number of ways. One of the things that stands out statistically to me the most is the fact that there were 25 goals scored. There were 15 unassisted goals, which meant that nothing came easy from an off-ball cleanup standpoint. And that was what had been Syracuse's issues defensively over the course of the last 2 years and even prior to that, right? It was that they could potentially match feet, but they were going to give up soft goals because of miscommunications off-ball. And obviously, that's how the game ended, and that'll be remembered pretty closely. But I think on like a game-long basis, there is a lot about this effort to be impressed by, especially when you consider that Will Mark finished with either 8 or 9 saves. not a great day for Will Mark. I mean, he is one of the best goalies in college lacrosse, and it would have been reasonable to expect him to be at 50-55% against a team like Maryland. He didn't get there, and yet defensively and at the faceoff X, I thought that Syracuse did everything that they needed to do in order to win the game. At the other end of the field, and this is for me probably the variable or the factor that led to Syracuse losing more than any other. You mentioned Spallina getting saved by Logan McNaney, and that was true. He got saved five times, but I didn't watch those goals and think that those were, I don't want to use the term ill-advised shots, because that's not what I'm referring to. Finn Thompson got saved three times, and I thought all three of those shots were the right shot to take. I thought the manner in which he released it and the speed on the shot, once he double clutched and still took the shot, and you know, he went low to low once, he went high to high another time, just not changing levels. I watched all three of those shots and I was like, it feels as if Syracuse does not have the proper amount of respect for Logan McNaney. And on the broadcast, Paul Calcaterra talked about how easy he makes it look. And I don't even think that's giving it the credit that's due. It's not about how easy he makes it look. It's how easy it actually is for this guy. And we had Liam Entenmann on the podcast before the season started, and he is rightfully the first team All-American, especially coming off of a national championship game, what he did in the NCAA tournament, and the fact that McNaney missed last season. But, I mean, for me, these two guys are the U.S. national team goalies. You know, who knows how long Blaze is going to play into his international career, but these two guys are so clearly the U.S. team goalies for the next, like, 12 years. Logan McNaney is incredible. He is such a security blanket. And what's crazy is, you know, the Ajax Apatello Joey Spallina matchup was something that folks were going to pay attention to coming into the game, and certainly it delivered in a lot of ways. What I found to be most interesting is Spallina's lone goal came off a pick that was set at X by Jackson Birtwistle, who was being covered by a short stick. Understandable that you wouldn't want to switch that pick, but it was a really nice pick with a lot of solid contact, and no slide came. And Patrick McEwen's reaction to that was just like, how are you not ready to support a Joey Spallina dodge from X in that scenario? And it just, I think, spoke more than anything else to the fact that, I'm assuming here, I don't know for sure, but Zapatello went into that game saying, don't slide to me. I got this. And when Spallina gets an assist off of the opening goal, it speaks to what Maryland kind of is under John Tillman. They are unshakable. They do not lose their plan, their approach, their focus, their attention, their calm, their composure, etc. They are the opposite of a Todd Monken-led Baltimore Ravens offense. And so to kind of like close the loop on what impressed me so much, you mentioned Maryland's ball movement, and I think that's true, but only in spurts. And I think the 15 unassisted goals kind of illustrates that. I have contended since the fall that this Maryland team had the potential to offensively get to 80-85% of 2022, which is an incredibly high standard. It's the best offense in the history of college lacrosse. They don't have guys who can get to the dirt like Keegan Kahn, your boy Anthony DeMeo, or Jonathan Donville. They have one guy who can do that in Braden Urksa, who was a problem for the Syracuse defense all night. But what they've got this year that they didn't have last year, in addition to a Braden Urksa who is not a freshman and has a year under his belt, is Eric Molliver, who is an incredible lever player. And what I mean by that is that when somebody else dodges and he catches the ball, Eric Molliver is very good at facilitating who should get the ball next. Now, he was limited to one assist yesterday, so it wasn't manifest in this game. But there was a goal in the second quarter that I thought so well illustrated just how audaciously Maryland was willing to move the ball. Two men behind the goal, I'm not going to remember who it was. I want to guess it was Syracuse to Maltz, but it was across the back of the net. Exchange pass from one side of the goal to the other, that if I'm correct in my memory, it was Syracuse to Maltz, and he went topside and finished in one of those upfield finishes. And I was like, that is the type of pass that we're talking about, where it's the pass that creates the goal. And again, if we're thinking about it in the context of how Maryland's going to get to their ceiling, get to their potential, you know, that's how it's going to happen. You want to talk about the waved off goal?
Two quick things before we talk about the waved off goal. Good call out on that ball movement, because there are ways where it's like, if they're just spinning it around the horn, like, you could argue that that's ball movement, but it was the decision making. And it's that fine detail of when you watch an offense that's not working and struggling versus you watch an offense that's, you know, kind of wheeling and dealing, where you're just like, what is happening? Is it off ball movement? Is it passing? Is it dodging? Is it drawing the slide? Like, there are a number of things that you can, you know, draw to. And that was the biggest difference in watching this Maryland offense, was it wasn't like, oh, that was a beautiful pick on the crease and then they fed it inside for an easy goal. It was the, oh, they just threw one skip pass to get it to the middie up top to set up. It was more teeing up their teammates to succeed based off of ball movement than it was leveraging ball movement to score. So as we watch Maryland's offense, it's those little skip passes to set up the open dodge, which then breaks down the defense. Like, that was kind of like the big takeaway for me, was like, they're just making good decisions to get people who need the ball on their stick. And that's essentially what's been missing. When I was watching other Maryland games, and I'm like, God, like, the defense is ready for everything that Maryland was throwing at them. That was the big difference. And it's a little one, and it's just, hey, the skip pass up top for the dodge, you know, getting it out of your stick as soon as the slide guy hedges and then moving it quickly to the backside. Massive, massive improvement in identifying the area in which Maryland should attack. And obviously it paid off. And the second point, and kind of a funny one, is when the goalies are hot and when it doesn't work, it looks like the dumbest, worst lacrosse of all time. There were no bad shots I didn't see at all last night. Every shot where normally I'm like, this is stupid. Like, you should probably pass the ball. Every shot I was like, this is probably going in. It just had that palpable energy where every shot was a good one. The moments were huge. And Syracuse, who I'd say probably has a 7th or 8th best fan base in lacrosse, I don't know what they're doing with their lights. I don't know how much that costs. I don't know what it was. It kind of had that feel of like, you score a goal, that's congrats. You just made a core memory, because the lights go dim and the crowd goes nuts. And, you know, the boos after the goal mouth. I was like, this is like, we are back. This, like, lacrosse season started with Maryland Syracuse. No offense to Colgate and no offense to, you know, everybody else. Now we can talk about the goal mouth. Everybody wants it canceled. Everybody wants it nuclear bombed into the sun. I am an antagonist and hater first by nature. I kind of love that this happened in the regular season just because people are pissed off about it.
Do you want Terry's history corner? Terry's lacrosse history corner?
Kind of badly at this point. Your knowledge of just, you know, drawing names from those Syracuse rosters and the way that you can frame it in a digestible manner that's not going to put me to sleep, we'll see, is second to none. Let's go to Scary Terry's History Corner. Take it away. All
right. So I'm going to start by sharing an anecdote that, I don't know, probably toes the line between on the record and off the record. But at one point, I told Bill Tierney, you are the most Machiavellian person in the sport. And he said, thank you. And the reason that's pertinent is because during the majority of his kind of Denver tenure, and maybe even before it, he was the IMLCA, which is the Coaches Association, representative to the NCAA Rules Committee, which means that he didn't vote. He provided some advisement, but generally speaking, he was meant to be the guy who represented the Coaches Association within this body. And obviously there's some redundancy built in because, you know, typically the committee is composed of, you know, 5 coaches and 4 administrators, and they span the gamut from Division I to Division III. And there is a representative from USA Lacrosse. There's a representative from the Officials Association. And then there's obviously NCAA folks there as well. So the dive was outlawed. This was before my time, 2001, 2003, somewhere in that range. And, you know, Doug Knight, Michael Watson, like, these were guys that popularized it to the point where for like the majority of the 2000s, there were t-shirts like Coed Naked and Bring Back the Dive. Like those were t-shirts that you could get in like Ocean City boardwalk stall huts or whatever. By like the mid 2010s, I don't recall anybody talking about the Dive. Then the 2017 semifinals happened between Denver and Maryland, our primary protagonists. And I believe it was Connor Cannizzaro, and I know for sure that it was Colin Heacock, that both made crease dive plays around the goal. And were they properly adjudicated? What did it do in terms of shining a spotlight on how hard it is to officiate this? Those were Final Four weekend storylines. But relative to the fact that this was 2017, we did not have a shot clock yet. We had the timer on, the half measure of all half measures. And all the Breaking Bad fans listening out there know how we feel about half measures.
Yeah, good reference. Jeez, Terry, go off.
I'm on fire on a Saturday on Sunday morning. We should mention, by the way, that like Notre Dame hasn't played Marquette yet, so there is a possibility that if the Fighting Irish go down to the Golden Eagles, we're going to have to re-record this entire intro, which is going to be very unfortunate for the last 30 minutes. But we're doing so that I can get to the championship series and then come home and not have to record with you very late at night. So. The shot clock, that was all people cared about. A shot clock. Like, give us a shot clock. That was all people cared about in 2017. So the rules committee meeting at the time was like the first weekend in August. And it coincided with, coincidentally, my wife and I, we would spend a week in Ocean City, and it was always like the first or second weekend in August. And so I was driving down, and I was getting texts on a Friday afternoon, sitting in like traffic on Route 50, which is like the most Maryland thing that you can do. I'm not from Maryland, by the way.
Congrats on that.
Yeah, very, very proud to have been from here. And I'm like, oh my God, first of all, there's a shot clock. Paul Rabel just broke the news. And second of all, like, I'm itching, right? I got my breaking news itch is going. So I start making all these calls around. And somebody's like, yeah, the Dive's coming back too. And I was like, what? So I called Coach T. And I was like, I heard the Dive's back. And he's like, well, I left yesterday. And it was not back, like, when I left. So they must have made that decision after I left. And they did, right? The Dive came back. And then, so we have the 2018 season, the 2019 season. My memory's getting a little bit murky here. But then very early in whichever, I believe it was the first year that the Dive was back, there was a Duke Furman game on, like, a Thursday night. And there were, like, three instances of dives where like the goalie was coming out to initiate contact, and there were these terrible collisions, and immediately everybody was like, oh, this is why we outlawed it in the first place. This is a problem. So then I think it was like, you know, the next rule cycle later, and I should, and again, if you've listened to this podcast, especially if you listen to our conversations after the quarterfinals and the Final Four last year, and I talked about my attitudes toward video review, this is a very close cousin to that point, which is I put a lot of priority on making the sport simple for fans. Typically, adding an extra line is not making things simpler. It is making things more complicated. And it wasn't just about the presence of the line. There were presentations when the goal mouth was added, and it was called the snow cone and all this other stuff, where the angle of the dodger was what mattered in terms of whether or not he ended up in the goal mouth, and it was, you know, the defense's responsibility, the offense's responsibility, whatever the case may be. So I immediately opposed this. I was like, this is dumb. This is, I understand the extent to which it is going to accomplish the spirit of the rule, which is to protect goalies. But once you get like a circle within a circle, then the question just becomes like, why not make the crease smaller and you're not allowed to go in it? You know what I mean? Like, I don't understand what we're trying to accomplish. Ultimately, it leads to this status quo where we're currently in. And it was interesting because listening to Gary and Tillman post-game kind of both made it seem like whatever the current situation is, it's not going to be in place next year. We're going into a rules change summer, and you know, ultimately, like, I think that there are a number of rules that should be reevaluated. I've spoken and written extensively about how I think that it shouldn't be a shot if you take it from your own half field, because I think 10-man riding is awesome. And I think that if you take a shot from your own half of the field and it's deemed a shot and you back it up, You're just bailing out a bag clear. That's a dumb rule. Let's get rid of that. But with that being said, like, I don't know whether the goal mouth is, like, I don't know whether what happened last night increases the likelihood that the goal mouth goes away. Does it change the way that fans perceive it? This is not like a Joey Sankey stuck behind the goal for 30 seconds and or 90 seconds and now we need a shot clock type rule. This is one of those things where it's like, I can imagine a scenario in which the rules committee doubles down, kind of in a similar way to what they did with video review after the Garrett Ledman crease call in the semifinals last year, where it's like, they're going to create more complication, more complexity around how to adjudicate this rule. Ultimately, what it comes down to is you can't end up in the goal mouth unless it's the result of illegal contact. If it's the result of illegal contact, the goal gets waved off, but it's a defensive penalty and the offense retains possession. If you end up, you can end up in the goal mouth as a result of contact, as long as it's legal or deemed not illegal, the goal gets waved off and what happened happened last night. That's what happens. And that's what I interpreted. I don't think what the Maryland defenders did to Michael Leo would have been illegal contact on any at any other point on the field. So he dives, he initiates diving. He lands in the crease after the ball has crossed the goal line, so legal dive. If he doesn't end up in the goal mouth, it is a good goal, but then he slides into the goal mouth. And there are folks who want to see you can't land in the goal mouth, but you can slide into the goal mouth, be a part of the next layer of adjudication or rule setting or whatever. And I'm just like, that to me is an illustration of like, you're taking something complex and making it more complex, right? As opposed to taking something complex and making it simpler, which should always be the goal. Your thoughts on the goal mouth?
They should have a rule where if they can't concisely explain it to my girlfriend's father, they cannot implement the rule. And he's from Long Island. And so if you get
it's in his blood, it's in his DNA.
What the hell are you guys talking about? What are we doing here? That's if that's the reaction, the rule is not implemented. And I am very much on the same page as you. And I draw like the just generally in life, things that I'm sick of talking about and explaining. Any sort of face-off rule or changes. I don't care what you do, stop changing it. Just let it be. And if you change it, just decide not to. Do something better with your time. That also goes right alongside this goal mouth and the goal crease. I am firmly on the stage of like, just, you know, make, if you're in the crease at all, like it's a penalty. Like just if there's a goal mouth, if there's a line within a line, like I am so sick of explaining this rule that by way of me having to explain it to more casual lacrosse fans, it implies that it's a bad rule in the first place. Hey, why is there this new line within the line that's out there? And I'm like, I just don't worry about it. It might be relevant at some point throughout the game. It might not.
Hopefully
just not. Don't even pay attention to it. So unfortunately, we align very much on that. It's face-offs, goal mouths, and defending the state of Idaho. I just don't do it anymore. They're like, why the hell are you living in Idaho? And I'm like, I don't care to explain this, and I'm not.
Well, after a $300 off-leash ticket, yeah, I wouldn't defend the state of Idaho if I were you either.
And yet I can carry an RPG into Chipotle and, you know, people wouldn't even bat an eye. Wild place. And so that's, it just goes down to simplicity and how quickly do the refs have a bigger say in the game. Make the refs having a say in the game as minimal as possible. And with this goal mouth rule, a lot of it in the same way that the timer on rule was kind of up for interpretation. It seems like, well, was it bad contact? Was he sliding into it? Did he land in it? Did the goal, you know, did the ball cross the goal before he landed in it? I'm just like, holy shit, guys. Like, let's just get rid of this. And to your point, if it's illegal push and he winds up in the crease, give the offense the ball with a 30-second or 1-minute penalty. If not, give the goalie the ball at X and then let them get on with the game and clear. And the more I watch in this, might be relevant, might not be. The more I watch the Sixes tournament in the PLL, the more I enjoy the pace of play. The more I start to really like this form of lacrosse because it's simple. Casual fans like Sixes more than they like watching a college lacrosse game, all else being equal. Granted that, you know, the alliances to college, I think, are stronger sure. than what the PLL is trying to build. But just consuming lacrosse and enjoying the game and not having refs be a part of it and not having to explain rules should be at the forefront and the priority of every rules decision that is made. And this seems completely counterintuitive, and I hate it, and it's ugly, and it's stupid. And that's my take on it. And that's the right take. And if you disagree with it, you know, I walk your dog without a leash at Cervidae Peak. Be my guest.
This game deserved roughly 30 minutes of conversation, but I think we've wrung most of the juice out of the rag that was Syracuse versus Maryland.
Yeah, and whoever won, as soon as it went to overtime, I already had the tweet preloaded. That's funny. Where I was like, this was a blowout. It shouldn't have gone to overtime. And, you know, who insert team that lost wasn't good. I tweeted out like, this game, you know, when is this game going to get excited? You know, Maryland won in a blowout. Couple, you know, you talk about Syracuse being good fans. They are unfunny, stupid, good, diehard fans.
That's what it is. No, you can't be smart and nuanced and be a good fan. Are you kidding me? Those are completely contradictory.
I had some spicy DMs where it was like, you know, they were like, and they immediately go to like, you're bald. What do you know? And I'm like, well, more than you, bucko. So I was having so much fun. I went out with some friends and, you know, had some cocktails last night and then ended up watching the end of the game. Shout out Syracuse fans for being just the lowest hanging fruit of the stir the pot negativity. And thanks for getting in my DMs. You gave me some great, great times. So credit to you. I'm going to still continue to say that Maryland won in a blowout. I loved Rambo's tweet of like cry about it, you know, turtle over orange. And I would have really loved to say Maryland lost in a blowout. So credit to everybody. We'll just open up the door behind this podcast. I'm gonna throw a little chirp to Ajax Zapatello right now. We were inviting him on this podcast. Oh, but he's at treatment. They got back at 4. This is the media grind. You know, what you do on the field is second to your online presence. So you could have lied. You could have logged.
Tell him to join from the treatment room.
I told him, I'm like, oh, what are you just getting heat and stem? And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, let's get next week. It's like more of an active recovery. And I'm like, shut up. You barely even played.
Have some heavy-duty wrap on his left hamstring, it looked like.
Oh, my left hamstring. That's how he sounded on the text. Great guy, though. I want to preface everybody. I know Ajax. I beat him in pickleball. He's a great guy. And we're just lightly having fun. Don't send a pipe bomb to my house.
His dad's the man, by the way. Incredible dresser.
Great people, top to bottom.
Opera guy. Okay,
so moving on. I was, you know, putting together this rundown. I'm like, do we just go right for the Hopkins Loyola street fight? I want to start with Richmond because I think they're going to be a team that we're going to talk about at length later when they do pull off an upset. So Richmond lost to Virginia 14-10. Some notable takeaways from this game. First off, the fans showed out. Shout out to the Richmond fans. Good atmosphere, good game. They were fired up that, you know, UVA was coming into town and their team, you know, answered the call. They had the lead early in the game. It was tied 9-9. So great job by Richmond. That was a team that when we were doing the over-under at the beginning, you know, I think I called out as like, there's always a couple teams that you hate to see on the schedule. I think Richmond now firmly solidifies themselves as this is the team that isn't going to do a lot for us if we beat them, but sure as shit, we better have our stuff together or they're going to pull the upset. Cormier ended up breaking the Virginia record. You know, UVA doesn't have a lot of lacrosse history, but that was still a cool little side note. You know, Dalton Young for Richmond, stud. And then it really was like Schellenberger and Boyden, you know, that kind of led the charge for Virginia. Even in Cormier's absence, UVA just had too many hitters, too many killers on the field, too many gorillas on the field, if you will. And does this game, Terry, I'll ask you, say more about Richmond or say more about UVA?
I think the combination of the Maryland and Virginia losses says more about Richmond. I wrote in my top 20 last week that I can imagine that this feels like a breakthrough year. And the reason is kind of the opposite of the reason that we talked about with Syracuse in terms of their orientation around stars. Like last year was impressive in terms of how they just kind of composed themselves without Ryan Lanchberry, who was the best player in program history. This year, I mean, obviously Dalton Young is awesome. That's not the point I'm trying to make. Like, I don't know, this is going to sound dumb for a team that has been to the NCAA tournament like 5 or 6 times in its 10-year history or whatever, but like it feels like another level of continuity and consistency from a program basis standpoint. And the fact that they took, so the way that I see the kind of top of the rankings right now is in my opinion, we've got a pretty clear, first of all, we got a very clear top three, right, in terms of Duke, Notre Dame, Virginia. I think that, you know, Maryland, and this has kind of been the point that I've made all along, like, is it actually top four and they're a part of it, or is it, you know, whatever from four to X and, you know, they're leading the way. I feel like if we were talking about quarterfinals right now, Maryland, Syracuse, Hopkins look like the other three. So that leaves two spots. And if you were to say, would you expect Richmond to get one of those spots? I mean, relative to some other teams, obviously Army just smoked Rutgers yesterday, so you got to look at them and be impressed. You know, Denver did not look good against Air Force and bounce back to kind of take it to Utah, so that was something as well. This, by the way, is a really good opportunity for you to chirp me about going over 5 in my picks this week, which I know you wanted to lead the podcast with and didn't have an opportunity to do. Going 0-5 is just as impressive as going 5-0, by the way.
You know, it depends on how you look at it. It's really
upside
not,
down.
Terry.
If you look at it from the back, like kind of like camera film, then it's the same.
You can't say look at it from the back and not have me make a joke, Terry. So, you know, again, we're a family-friendly podcast, but I'll, you know, spare you on this time.
Nick will make that joke in Venmo if you send him $5.
Yeah. And to cover the ticket. Help Nick not be homeless. Pay off his ticket. Here's the deal, Terry. What were you thinking choosing Utah? What were you thinking choosing Loyola? Like, where was your head at? Were you just trying to play antagonist and being like, oh, I'm going to go 0-5 because my hindsight's 20/20 and I certainly wouldn't have gone 0-5. So bad. Boo.
So Utah was, I mean, a lot of people didn't pay attention to that Denver Air Force game. I mean, Denver should have lost. They failed 9 clears. They had, I don't know, a lot of 29-28 turnovers, something like that. If the faceoff X had been more even, they would have lost. So that was where, and then, you know, Utah just kind of, I don't know, didn't score in the last 40 minutes against Ohio State. That was a concern, but they also got off to a really nice start in the first 20 minutes against Ohio State. And we already talked about that West team playing East, et cetera. And they were at home. So it was, you know, I don't know, 55-45 Utah over Denver pick.
Love how Loyola, you just blew past that. Oh, they also didn't score for 40 minutes against Ohio State, as if that wasn't like, yeah, they didn't score for 40 minutes. They're not a team that's going to put up points. So bad on you.
Yeah. Well, I thought that the like stylistic identity, right? Like Utah being so transition oriented and Denver having failed so many clears was going to manifest in an opportunity, and it didn't. I watched that game. It wasn't really ever close.
Yeah, but let's not get sidetracked. We're still talking UVA Richmond.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. If I had picked this one, I'm not sure that there's a part of me that would have picked Richmond. There's also a part of me that might have picked Fairfield over Carolina, right? So, like, it was just I was expecting things that did not happen. I don't have a ton more
like
to say.
Sounds like my Friday nights. Okay, go ahead.
I don't have a ton more to say about Richmond versus Virginia. I think that, like I said, you know, to me, Richmond is a bona fide quarterfinal contender. Obviously, they're going to have to, you know, get one of these games, right? Whether it be in the first round of the NCAA tournament or not. You know, they're if they don't get a, well, honestly, at this point, if they don't beat Duke and Georgetown, they're probably not going to be in a seeded position that's going to make it that they're, you know, not playing one of those top three in the first round of the NCAA tournament, which certainly is going to make it a little bit more difficult. But yeah, I mean, Virginia, like, I don't know, you know, they're awesome. If they're going to win faceoffs, you know, if they're going to make saves, they're awesome.
Got it.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and that was more just like, I wanted to highlight Richmond. You know, you lose by 1 to Maryland, you lose by 4 to Virginia. What, like, watch out for the Spiders.
Well, yeah, I mean, more than losing by 4, it's tied 9-9, you know, late in the game. You played them evenly for however long that was, 43 minutes, something like that.
Yeah. And so moving on, shout out Richmond. Good job. Bravo. Moving on, this game was as much fun as Maryland Syracuse was. This game was equally, if not more fun, if you are a depressed football fan that is sad that you're not going to see CTE implemented in athletes for the next couple months. Hopkins, Loyola, deem the Battle of Charles Street. This game, bring your brass knuckles, bring your pipes, bring your grenades, and just throw them at the other team. So Hopkins ended up winning the game. What was the final? 13-7?
Yes.
I had that written down, and I'm just not seeing it right now. And it was mostly a street fight. I mean, half Loyola spent 90% of their time in the box. You know, Mustang Sally led with the crown of his helmet in a textbook slide. Everything ended up with, like, those five, you know, it's not a fight, but they're certainly in each other's faces. So what a great game that was to watch, and what a treat. Couple players to highlight, and I just want to, like, preface this by, I love just mispronouncing it in my head and how I read them on paper. And, you know, like, Angelus is an old, you know, there's this old Bugs Bunny where he's like, how do I get to Los Angeles? And I can't get that out of my head every time I see his name. So I'm just going to call him Angelus. Went 4-3. And Hopkins scored a few late. So this game was a little bit closer than it seemed. And really the story for me was just Loyola not being able to stay out of the box and let the rivalry kind of take over their entire team. Certainly a winnable game for them. But credit to them for just during a regular season. We'll see if Loyola can sneak into the tournament. You know, let's just go out and try and hurt our rivals. Whereas Hopkins had a little bit more composure. I don't want to give them any credit by any means. But seemed to be able to execute on some of the man-ups, seemed to be able to, in those scuffles, kind of maybe have saner heads prevail. And what a game. If you didn't watch this game, just go back and watch it and just watch fights. I loved it.
Not just fights, but violence of other varieties. Nick, check your text messages for the photo that I just sent you. I want to hear your reaction in real time.
I mean, that's just good lacrosse. It's just good lacrosse. Just contact. A couple boys contacting each other.
Alex Bean, Loyola defender, left the game due to injury. After eating a shot from Garrett Degnan, who was a star in this game with four goals and was a demon on the ride, he ate the shot in the... well, let's just say, remember when you asked Liam Entenmann to go cup check Jordan Faison and Tyler Buchner? Let's hope somebody did that for Alex Bean earlier in the game.
Please, because I and the location, like, just looking at this picture, the ball is, it could essentially, like, if he was naked, that could be the blurred out spot. It is textbook placement. You know, ball on ball action. And hey, you have to go get emergency surgery and you end up losing a quarter of it, give me a call. I'll walk you through the entire recovery process. I'll give you the tips of the trade on that. But ouch.
Loyola has problems offensively, which is crazy for a team that scored 18 games in their opener, 18 goals in their opener. They scored 4 against Maryland last week. They were limited to 7 against Hopkins on Saturday. And it's crazy because they shouldn't be playing as well defensively as they are on the basis of how new and young they are. Luke Stout is playing tremendously. He's bailing them out a little bit or a lot, depending on your point of view. But yeah, I mean, you know, they're a borderline top 20 team. You know, they're not too far behind that. You know, we saw another borderline top 20 team in Boston University lose at home to Bryant on Friday. So as it comes to the Patriot League, right, it seems as if there's just substantial separation between Army and the rest of the group, but we've seen this before. And, you know, to expect Army to run away with it would be foolish. Like, there's going to be a reckoning at some point, either in the regular season or probably more likely in the Patriot League tournament. So, sports are sports. Hopkins, I continue to be disappointed in the correlation between how many guys they can rely on to make plays offensively and how productive they are offensively. This feels like a team that should be producing at 35 to 40% offensive efficiency, which, yes, is, like, insane. I get it. It's you know, that's historically good. Like, there haven't been that many teams that finish the season over 40%. this team should be talented enough to do it. Jacob Angeles, you mentioned, one thing you left out is that he's from the area and he missed last year's game. And he talked about post-game how he missed it due to injury. And he talked about post-game on Saturday that, you know, that meant something to him. His absence and a couple other Blue Jay absences led to, you know, a performance that Loyola won in Ridley, and the final score, I don't remember what it was. I feel like it was 11-6 or something like that, but it was 11-2. It was one of the most dominant games I had recalled at that, like, to that point in the game, having been at in a really, really long time. And so I would imagine that he brought a little bit more piss and vinegar to this one, and his stat line certainly showed it, as did Degnan. So, you know, when you look at it through that lens, it's a rivalry game that was carried by their vets, right? But this is a team that, you know, they got more out of Matthew Collison than they had previously gotten. They lost Brooks English in the first half due to, I didn't see the, Matt Kinnear was covering this game, so I didn't watch it live. I'm gonna have to rewatch it. But he was in a boot, so ankle foot maybe, I guess. Hopefully not too severe. He's kind of their party starter in a meaningful way. And then they still need more out of Russell Melendez. They haven't gotten the pressure that he provides on opposing defenses in consistent stretches. But they have gotten good performances out of Dylan Bauer. So it's dispersed and diffuse. You know, despite the fact that obviously Angeles is averaging, you know, whatever he's averaging, 5 or 6 points a game at this point, but they're spreading it around to the other 9 midfielders. And my question is, when you are trying to incorporate that many guys, is it just built into the plan that it's going to take more time? Because as opposed to trying to get 6 guys or 5 guys clicking from the midfield, if you try to get 9, just by virtue of numbers, you're going to get that level of variety and variability on a game-to-game basis. Maybe it helps you in the intermediate and long term, specifically when there's injuries, right? Like, they're better positioned to lose Brooks English than they would be if they hadn't been playing the third line. And maybe it's a shield against fatigue late in the season. But for this point, when you're trying to build chemistry and continuity, doing so with more guys might just come with the inherent cost of taking longer to get up to speed.
And that could be a recurring theme that's brought up consistently on this podcast, is we've kind of talked a number of times. I think it was maybe it was like Maryland or Hopkins even last year. We were like, you know, they have, you know, 6 midfielders that are all contributing, but at what point do, you know, you separate? And so maybe we keep a running tab of like the too many cooks in the kitchen meter. And when does that clarify? And when does that sauce start to reduce into something tasty?
Good analogy, Chef Nico.
I made quesabirria tacos last week for the first time, and now I'm just like, oh, what am I cooking today? I got a sourdough starter now. Wow.
You guys will be stunned by the confidence with which Nick told me that making naan is easy.
Shockingly easy. You just put flour, olive oil, yogurt, and you put it on a cast iron skillet. You let it sit there. Naan and focaccia. If you're looking to get into bread, start with naan and start with focaccia, and you'll be like, wow, I'm a good baker. And then you'll try and make sourdough, and the oven will explode. Or so I heard. So moving on, a sleeper good game this one was. Yale versus Villanova. In this one, not to you know, draw a comparison to what the game of the week was, Maryland-Syracuse, but this kind of had a little bit of that back and forth shit show-esque. You know, watching this, I was like, what is happening? Like, every goal seemed to be a complete defensive breakdown. Every time Villanova cleared the ball, Yale somehow left somebody wide open in the first 20 seconds of the substitution. But Yale jumped out to a 5-goal lead, blew it, and then ended up winning. You know, Cool scored the last 2 goals of the game after being cold for a vast majority of it.
Wow.
What?
Cool was cold?
Yeah.
Pun.
I didn't even notice that. That's how good I am. Poet, and I don't even know it. So Yale had the 5-goal lead. They ended up blowing it. Cool warmed up. Now that's funny. Scored the last 2, and, you know, Licata had 4 for Nova, Brandau had 4 assists, so he wasn't kind of in that prominent scoring position, but still showing that he's, you know, Yale's offensive spark. And what I loved about this game was it seemed to me like just an absolute tale of two styles. Villanova on the clear early in the possessions in the transition game was like, hey, we do not want to go toe to toe with Yale in a straight settled 6-on-6 format. Let's manufacture and find goals. Yale, to me, the difference was we are more comfortable in 6-on-6. We can attack from behind the cage. We can have good crease movement that Villanova won't be able to adjust to throughout the game. And the difference to me was Yale, on top of that comfortability in 6-on-6, ended up with a couple goals off the faceoff, and they manufactured this win over the style of play that Villanova was more comfortable with. So off the faceoff and in some of those, hey, this is outside of our settled 6-on-6, which we want this to be a settled 6-on-6 game, Yale comes away with the win.
There are so many different ways that you could unpack this game, because all of your preconceptions, there's just such a variety of preconceptions. So one of them is, if you thought Villanova was really going to struggle this year because of their performances against Rutgers in a scrimmage and then their performance against Penn State in their opener, then you can look at this result and be like, oh man, Yale is in trouble. But on the other hand, if you look at it and say, well, the strength of Yale's team was going to be its attack, and they were playing without its two starting attackmen in Chris Lyons and Leo Johnson, you can kind of say the fact they survived and got the W at all is to be celebrated, or a sense of relief or whatever. So, and then there's like, because of what you just laid out, like there's a ton of variety even within just unpacking the game in and of itself. So, you know, the storyline for this ELC season is going to be, and they talked about it on the web stream, they haven't had a defensive identity since 2018, 2019. Are they going to be able to find it over the course of the year? It was the focus of the offseason. I thought that Patrick Pisano inserted into the starting lineup, he finished with 5 ground balls and 4 caused turnovers, turned the ball over once himself. I thought that was an illustration of what they have needed, which is, they, to me, though it's been frustrating, and you know, so Yale, let me just get this off. Scoring offense, scoring defense does not matter. It is not a good indication of how good you are at offense or defense. Because more than anything else, it is an indication of either how often you win or lose faceoffs or how fast you play. Those are the two things that influence those numbers more than anything else. That's why offensive efficiency and defensive efficiency, the percentage of possessions in which you score or give up goals, matters way worse. And then if you can adjust it for how good your opponent is, now you're starting to get somewhere. And we do that. We publish it a couple times a year. We need to get it in a permanent place on our website. It's on Lax Reference. We define possessions differently, so that's why the numbers are different, and that's fine. It's a conversation for another time. Yale has the number 5 offense last year and the number 33 defense by that metric, right? Whereas then scoring defense, they had the 62 defense. Huge gap between 33 and 62 in terms of how good or bad they actually are. But they play super fast, and that's why they gave up a ton of goals. But they also scored a ton of goals. So again, it's a stylistic choice. It's not a function necessarily of how good or bad you are. That being said, 33 is not good enough for a team that wants to win a national championship, right? Like, they need to have a top 20 adjusted defensive efficiency if they expect to compete at the level that they want to compete at. And they can do it. That's what they did in 2018 and 19. So it's not unattainable. But what they have been is a team that's been able to match feet and play good defense on ball for 40 seconds. 50 seconds in a possession. When you distilled a lot of their goals that they gave up last year, it came off of rebounds. It came off of weird batted passes where the opponent came up with the ground ball and was totally naked and just easy shot. Those are the types of plays. I mean, you talked about it. Early possession, lack of matching up quickly in the substitution game. Like, these are the types of goals that they have given up with too much regularity over the course of the last 3 seasons, and that is what they need to get cleaned up. But to me, that was not what the story of this game was. The story of this game was the drought that their offense went through during that 5-goal Villanova run. Because when they got out to that lead, and it was close through the first, I mean, it was 7-5 with 2 minutes to go in the second quarter, and it felt very much like Villanova was in striking distance, and then Yale scored twice right before halftime, and then scored first coming out of half to make that, extend that 5-goal lead. But then they went dry for both, basically the entire third quarter. And what I saw was a Yale offense that was able to be productive early because their midfielders were dodging with so much intention. But then they started to defer to Brandao once he got a little hot. And, you know, they got sloppy with their stick work, and it just felt like there was a lack of focus or a loss of focus that until Villanova tied it up, they just weren't able to get their arms back around. And then, yeah, I mean, Carson Kuhl was one of the two players, David Anderson being the other, who subbed in for the two missing attackmen. And it was interesting in the way that they reoriented where they wanted their guys on the field. You know, last year they were a pretty commonly a two-behind team with Brando on the right side and Johnson on the left side. Lyons would float to X when he wanted to dodge an attack, but for the most part he was on that righty wing. Brando was a lot more often on the righty wing, and Kuhl was behind with Anderson kind of in the middle. And point being that, you know, Carson Kuhl was a really good midfielder for this team last year. Now he's being put in a much more demanding position, and he just didn't perform early in the game, in my opinion. But down the stretch, when they needed him, he was the difference, and he was the reason that they won. And so, you know, he's going to get a lot of kudos because of that. But at the same time, in terms of this team meeting its ceiling, his performance is going to have to be better.
Idiot brain note from me. Every time I saw Kuhl and like the jersey, and credit to you or whoever put out that name a random player, and John Clue was one of
yes.
them.
Yes,
like the, he was so good.
Did you ever have to like match up with him?
Yeah,
did you ever have to guard him?
He got 8 yards of separation with a 3 yard dodge. Like he had me going that way, and then he cut that way and scored. And I was like, Coach, I think we should pull that guy. I don't really want to play against him. For those who don't know, John Clue was, tough to start without mentioning his height, but he was this tiny little player that, you know, when we would go play Villanova, we knew that we were the favorites. We knew that we would, you know, try and win. And we were like, who's this little guy? Who does he think he is? Yeah, he had a good game against, you know, insert program last week. But watch what he does here. And then he went like 5-4 against us. And we were like, oh, shit, this kid's nasty.
Yeah. Well, he was also one of the original like 6-year guys because he suffered a bunch of season-ending
injuries. Kept getting his knee. Yeah, I think he kept blowing out his knee. So like 4 years after I graduated, I saw like Clue was playing in like his final game. And I'm like, that guy's still playing? Like what is happening? And now that happens every year.
But let me say that I actually think Villanova's pretty good. I think that they're really young offensively and it's going to take some time, but they've got pieces and you know, that's not a surprise when you lose, Matt Campbell Patrick Daly. I mean, you know, those were guys that had been around for a really long time and, you know, it was on the heels of, losing Connor Kearse 2 years prior to that. So, you know, this is a team who has been very star oriented. And they've graduated their stars. So now it just takes time to build in the stars that are coming behind them. But, you know, you could have looked at the first couple of results, scrimmages and game included, and said, like, I don't know if there's the talent on this team where there are stars coming. And what I saw yesterday in Matt Licata and a couple of the other young guys is that, you know, they're smaller, which is going to be a challenge. It's kind of always been the case, as we just discussed with John Clue. But that wasn't the case with Campbell and Daly. So, you know, in some respects, it's going to be a little bit of a different formula. But yeah, there's enough talent in this team where they're coming.
The next game, and again, this was an interesting rundown to put together because I'm like, you know, do I want to talk about an upset or do I want to talk about like a bigger, objectively better matchup game? I want to talk about upsets, Terry, because there weren't a lot of them this weekend. But what can Brown do for you? Not much. And the I can't remember who tweeted it out, but like the Duke losing to Air Force in February is now Quinnipiac beating Brown in February. Brown loses 13-7. They struggled offensively. You know, Aiden McLean had 3 goals, and other than that, not a whole lot going. And really the reason I wanted to talk about this is my dear friend Larkin Kemp, who has just had a really tough time dealing with this loss. And he was in the group chat that we're in, and he's like, guys, I don't pretend that Brown's going to win the national championship. But
yes,
I
do. Yes, he does.
Well, he pretends, but he's like, you know, I just want Brown to be good enough to where I can get in the mix and talk about this. And now with this loss to Quinnipiac, he, you know, maybe we call in a wellness check for our good friend Larkin, who has had nothing but the hardest life of anybody that I've ever met. So, Larkin, this one's for you. Terry, let's talk Quinnipiac beating Brown on February 17th.
I have nothing to say about this game.
Then we can move on. I just was
on it at all, and you covered everything that needed to be covered about it. But congratulations to Coach Pulley and the Bobcats. Yeah, the Bobcats.
That, and unfortunately, everything that I do with college lacrosse now is going to be viewed through the lens of Notre Dame being snubbed, Notre Dame and Duke being snubbed in order to make room for the Ivy League.
Sure,
so unfortunately, Larkin, great guy. But anytime I see an Ivy League getting upset, I'm like, ha ha, 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 go kick rocks. Nanana boo boo, stick your head in doo doo. That's Vickers, you know, page 45. Yeah, I read that too.
I'm almost done with Clearly as the Flower Moon. My concern, my preseason concern, I did not finish it before the season started. So B, it's taken me longer to finish it than it would have. But C, I think I'm actually going to get it done. I'm finding Friday night, I plowed through like another 40 or 50 pages. So I've got part three to go, which is not nearly as long as part one or part two. So we're going to find out what this mystery was all about, David Gran.
Zero to 10. How would you rate the book?
I mean, if you like history and specifically like that era and kind of Native American history, it's like a 9.7. It's riveting, but like, it's very particular. Like, my wife is a kind of murder mystery fiction person, and I it was funny because so the copy I'm reading I stole from my parents because I got it over Christmas. She was like, so she didn't know that it got turned into a movie, and so she like saw the trailer, I don't know, on Instagram or whatever, and then she went into like the bedroom in our house where we have like a bookcase with all the books on it, and then there was a different copy on the bookshelf. She's like, what is going on? I can't get away from this book. And I was like, oh yeah, that reminds me. I definitely pulled it off of like a free little library for you like a year ago when I heard Ryan Rosillo interview David Gran because I thought you might find it interesting. And she's like, would I? And I was like, no, absolutely not. Like, this is not your cup of tea.
God, I'm revisiting. All right, Nick and Terry's book club, 10-second conversation, but I'm revisiting a favorite nonfiction book of mine called Guns, Germs, and Steel. And essentially the premise is a very prominent anthropologist is walking around Papua New Guinea with a native tribe there. And the entire book is kind of stems from the conversation he was having with this tribal elder where he's like, you know, essentially he's asking like, how have you guys not developed modern technology? Like, are you stupid is an offensive way to frame it. But as he walks around Papua New Guinea with this elder, the elder is like identifying plants and talking about the ecosystem and sharing a depth of knowledge that blew this guy away. So he revisits how did civilizations get to guns, germs, and steel? Meanwhile, other people didn't. And like, you know, the fact that the horse can be domesticated and the zebra can't. Like these weird fluke, one-off, like crazy happenstances essentially led, you know, all the what we see today. Like America just happened to have the right resources. These people happen to not. It's talking about the Fertile Crescent and like where Iran and Turkey and, you know, that area is where most of civilization started with math, with writing. Right now,
written word
and like all this stuff. And I'm just like, oh, this is so great. And then I'm deciding between Anna Karenina and Moby Dick for my next book. Which one should I go with?
How much do you want to cry?
Oh, so much, Terry?
Then definitely Anna Karenina.
Okay, I'm going to read Anna Karenina. Done. All right, moving on. Thanks for joining Nick and Terry's book club. Let's dogpile on the Ivy League. We just talked about how Brown lost. Georgetown beats Penn 12-9. You know, again, not a whole lot from this. I think this was a relatively expected score. You know, the storylines from this... James Ball won faceoffs. Like that to me was the number one factor. You know, Aiden McLean
and Penn lost their top two faceoff guys in game to injury.
Yep. So when they go down, obviously, you know, that's going to have a much bigger impact than another individual player going down. Steve Germain with 7 points. Shout out to him. Or sorry, that's Brown. TJ Haley had 5 assists. That's the one. And then Walsh for Penn had 3 goals. Really, the reason why I wanted to layer these back to back is that the Ivy League is stinky, and I haven't forgiven them for what they did to my ACC brothers Duke and my alma mater Notre Dame. Anything to take away from Georgetown beating Penn?
So I would lump Georgetown beating Penn, Bucknell beating Dartmouth, and Colgate beating Albany into one category, which is it's really hard to play your first game against a team that's already played a game. And that's even more true when they've played, in, for instance, Colgate's case, four games. So it's not to say that that's why these teams won. It's just to say that the way that the games unfolded, in my opinion, were a reflection of the fact that it's not only hard to win, it's hard to come out of the gate. It's hard to understand kind of, you know how like, I can't remember the anecdote, but somebody was talking about, they went to an NHL game in December and they're like, whatever. And then they went to a playoff hockey game. Oh, no. It was like, they went to a playoff hockey game. It was their first playoff hockey game. And they're like, Dad, why don't they play this hard all the time? And the answer was because if they did, like, they wouldn't make it to December. That was the December part of the anecdote. I think that's true for the transition from scrimmages and practice into games, right? Like, and if it's two teams playing their first game at the same time, then there's no advantage. But when one team has game speed experience and the other team doesn't, it's going to take a quarter for the team that's playing its first game to just get up to game speed. And I think that's what you saw. And, you know, all of these teams dug themselves to some extent out of the early hole, but not enough to secure the win. And Georgetown needed to win. You know, Penn, we've talked about all the time, like, there is no room on their schedule. But at the same time, like, they're going to play close games and they're going to be decent and they're going to win a few of them. And, you know, we'll see what that means and how it manifests over the course of the year. But for the time being, you know, I think Penn's going to be fine. But they also, it's not just about getting up to game speed. They have to kind of re-identify themselves or reform their identity without Sam Hanley and Dylan Gergar. So, you know, those are two guys. If you look at the percentage of shots they took last year, of course, it's going to be a steep learning curve for the other five guys four guys on the field and two new guys.
Yeah, no, tough to win when your first game is against a team that has already played. Notre Dame would like a word, 25-3 with an own goal. So good point there, Terry.
Yeah, how about that own goal?
Everybody that sent me that, I just go, so, you know, it's crazy what AI videos can do. Doesn't that look real? But, you know, hey, don't believe everything that you read on the internet.
How did you feel about your either former or I don't even know the extent to which he still is your other podcast co-host? His comment was, I would ruin this player's love for the game within 4 days if he did that to me.
I would probably make it three. he could go on to win a Nobel Prize. And if it like... Because we were talking about like what we would do in that situation if it was like your teammate that did that. And the first thing is I was like, if we were playing beer pong that night, I would immediately shoot it into my own cup and go, oh, I just pulled a, and then, you know, do that on your own last name. It like, that's the exact game, you know, again, 25-3. Game was never...
By the way, it was Will Donovan, and it wasn't like the normal own goal where like you're trying to throw the ball back to your goalie or you're scooping it or whatever. Like no, he picked up the ball off the wing of the faceoff and just thought he was going toward Cleveland State's goal. Like he tried to score on the goal. He threw the ball into the net on purpose. It just happened it was his own.
And like the moment of realization is like, what, it's one of my sneaky favorite moments of the year. And I know it's going to be just because I'm like, can you imagine the bits, Terry? You get back into the locker room after winning. Coach Corrigan gives this whole speech about, hey, that's how we wanted to start the season, this and that. And the second you hear the door close when he steps out of the locker room, everybody just starts dogpiling on him. Like, and I hope Will Donovan has that sense of humor where he can do it to himself and you know, understand that the butt of the joke is in jest and in love. But if he ever wins a Nobel Prize and be like, that's the guy that scored on himself. It's too funny of a situation. Okay, question for you. The most notable slaughter of the weekend. DU over your precious Utes, 16-8. Towson over Navy, 17-5. Or Army over Rutgers 16-7. All complete blowouts, couple different things to discuss within each game, but you know, what was the most notable slaughter of the weekend?
So definitely not Denver, Utah. Get that out of here. That doesn't matter.
Okay.
So the one that matters way more in terms of the national landscape is Army over Rutgers. And I think you can spin it both ways because, and it also, I think you kind of have to incorporate UMass into this as well because, you know, they played Army to a one goal game last week and had every opportunity to win. So you can infer from that, UMass might be pretty good, right? That's an important consideration. If you were coming away from that UMass game saying, like, is Army as good as we think we are? Well, this would say, like, yeah, they probably are. And then the other side of the question, obviously, is, like, does Rutgers kind of stink? And I think the answer is, like, we won't know until we get more data on exactly how good Army is. If Army is, like, very clearly in that top seven, we talked about earlier how I felt like there was a clear top six, and there might be a clear top seven, and Army might belong in it, then you don't have to be that concerned as a Rutgers fan because, you know, there are a combination of injuries, new guys, et cetera, that need to get bedded in. And there is like kind of organic growth ahead of this team. But if Army is, you know, 12th or 15th in the country and they put on that performance, then yeah, that's cause for concern. On the other end, Towson 17, Navy 5.
Yikes. Like,
I mean, that is just an avalanche going downhill, and there's you just don't know what end is in sight. You know what I mean? Like, I watched the Navy Hofstra film and didn't come away encouraged, despite the fact that they controlled the game if I was a Navy fan. It's interesting. You know, Xavier Arline is, you know, he was, I think, the number 5 recruit in the class, went to Navy in order to be a two-sport athlete, has been a starting quarterback for the midshipmen. When he was replaced as a starting quarterback this year, he still found himself back in that role at times throughout the season. And I felt like for the last two lacrosse seasons, the combination of his injuries and the, like, very apparent lack of continuity because he was still practicing football was worth more than it was benefiting, right? I didn't feel that way watching the Hofstra game. I thought that, like, what he brought was unlike what anybody else could bring in. And that has been true, right? So that's why you accept the cost for the benefit. I just felt like watching that game that the ratio was a little bit more in the benefit relationship or the benefit end of the spectrum this year. Is it the 17 goals you allowed or the 5 goals you scored? That was the problem, right? And I think ultimately it doesn't matter. It's a burn the film, whiteboard everything. Like, I don't know how you make a Navy practice harder on Monday than a typical Navy practice already is, but you do it, and I don't know, man. I mean, don't get me wrong. Towson looked good for about 40 minutes against Hopkins, but we've already established that, like, this is not a peak-performing Hopkins team. So Towson is better. There's no question about it. Now, are they going to win the CAA? I don't know, but even if Towson wins the CAA, Navy shouldn't be losing to him by 12 goals.
No. And
am I right? It's Navy Towson is that's the most substantial outcome, right?
And, like, there are blowouts. Like, even the difference between 16-8 and 17-5, like, 5? Holy shit, boys. And, you know, it's always like I love the storylines when it happens, but I don't expect it to happen any particular year. But, like, you know, the Commander-in-Chief trophy and where Army, Navy, and Air Force are. It's just like, all right, I'm already kind of bummed out that it is just so clearly Army and then a cliff. And then I'll put Air Force above Navy, strictly because Will Corrigan is a good friend of mine. I coached at Idaho and, you know, I do coaches clinics and that's what the technical difficulties were last week. Was I was driving back from Richland, Washington.
I coached at Air Force.
The Chair Force is what we were called. And then the Hair Force when I, you know, was hanging onto my hair. You want good bits? Go to the military because they can make a joke out of literally anything. But yeah, coached at Air Force. My good friend coaches there now. So I'm going to put Army way at the top. Big cliff, and then Air Force, who frustrating to watch their defense. We won't talk about their loss to Ohio State, but I just watched that and I want to, you know, ram my head into a wall. And then Navy at the bottom. So to wrap this up, we'll just do a little choose your own storyline adventure for you, Terry. Colgate 3-1. St. Joe's kept it close with Duke for a bit, but Duke might not lose a game ever again in history. But Duke also has way more program losses than Lemoyne at the Division I level, who's now 1-0. Out of those three things, Colgate's hot start, Duke looking unstoppable, Lemoyne having less Division I losses than Duke.
Yeah, Colgate we kind of already touched on. So just to say to that, you know, they've got Yale next, or at least Yale has them next. I assume that the Raiders do not have a game in between now and then, because that would be insane. They've already played a lot. But
shout out Coach Carwick. Keep crushing it.
Indeed. I checked in on the Duke St. Joe's game when it was a little close, and then it became not very close pretty quickly. So. I've referenced this previously in other places. You know, when Zach Lowe talks about Ben Simmons, he says the only thing he cares about is whether or not he's willing to get fouled, not afraid of getting fouled. The only thing I care about with Duke is how are they utilizing Andrew McAdory. So a little bit more against St. Joe's, but I still want to see more. And Lemoyne, congrats to Dan Sheehan, congrats to the Dolphins. You know, Wagner obviously has been a program that has had fits and starts, specifically during the Will Manny assistant coach era. They kind of reached the recent crescendo of that program, but a good one for the Dolphins. A bummer that they have to play an independent schedule this year, because you wonder, you know, what does a Division II team, you know, playing in a Division I conference look like? If it has all the built-in advantages of extending your motivation throughout the year, because you know you're going to have the opportunity to compete for an NCAA tournament berth on, you know, the last weekend in April or first weekend in May. The fact they don't have that means that their battle is going to be their internal motivation. And, you know, that's tough. You have to do a really good coaching job in order to make sure that your guys are getting better every single day. But winning is one of the things that helps a lot, and winning your first game probably helps more than any other way to do that. So again, congrats to the Dolphins and good luck going forward. Nick, that'll do it. We gave the people what they didn't get last week, which was both a podcast and then probably like an additional extra 20 or 30 minutes of a podcast. So now granted, a decent percentage of it was talking about the Idaho Fishing Game Association or warden or office or department or whatever, and then a little bit about Anna Karenina as well. So I'm not sure that it was exactly what they paid for, which was nothing, because you paid $0 for this podcast. But yeah, maybe you can slide into Nick's Venmo and get some of those jokes that he was withholding in order to keep this family friendly.
That one was for me. I think I needed that. I think, you know, using a podcast for public therapy is certainly a decision. And I heard a joke.
No, it's
today.
A prerequisite. It is not a decision. If you've ever listened to anybody else's podcast, you know that
you guys
it is exclusively
hear about my
for self gratification.
Yeah. We'll leave it with a joke. I don't know how everyone in China didn't see the famine that Mao Zedong implemented with his decision making. I don't know how they didn't see it coming. There were red flags everywhere. Thanks for coming on the podcast. You guys
Carson
have been great.
Cool Carson Cold pun, but that's what you did.
Tip your waitresses. You guys have been awesome. We'll see you next week.
Love you, Nick.
Love you, Terry.